Bagel's Secret Police Reviews of Literature. Bagel was one of the Stasi's informers who regularly wrote classified reviews on consignment for the Stasi and was thus a player in the invisible clandestine part of the censorship apparatus. He was, in effect, one of the faceless censors of literature. In his capacity as a Stasi reader, Bagel reviewed and, as we shall hear, mostly tried to sabotage the publication of works by a string of notable writers, Sara Kirsch and Paul Wiens. He also spied on both of them, as mentioned, Rainer Kirsch, Monika Maron, Günther Kunert, Klaus Poche, Erich Löst, Lutz Rathenow, Wolfgang Hilbig, Eva Strittmatter, Franz Fühmann, and Bettina Wegner. From 1969 to 1979, he wrote pre-publication reviews of manuscripts for the Stasi. From around 1980 onward, he wrote post-publication reports for the Stasi on works that had already been published, often illegally, in the West. In his reports that were meant only for the Stasi's eyes, Bagel openly vented his displeasure at the anti-socialist stance of contemporary literature. He was free to do so because he wrote what we now call single-blind peer reviews. Vanna Mittensvei calls manuscript reviews the most important form of communication with the censorship office. And in recognition of this fact, the Stasi engineered its own reviews so that it could have a say in this process. However, unlike other reviews, those commissioned by the Stasi were not only single-blind, they were also classified information that was not passed on to the author. Rather than the instrument of quality control to eliminate bias that we know from academic peer reviewing, the Stasi's assessments served a rather different purpose. These reviewers made no attempt at being impartial or objective, but were instead aimed at enforcing a particularly narrow socialist, realist style of writing and policing the ideological content of works. Bagel saw himself as an aesthetic gatekeeper in his behind-the-scenes reviews and as a political vigilante who was determined to ensure works with damaging messages or subversive intent did not pass muster. In his rigid view, works could be security risks if they pointed to their author's hostile disposition and attitude vis-à-vis socialism, or if they were written in dangerous styles, that is, if they drew on modernist, romantic, avant-garde, or expressionist traditions. All these reactionary rather than progressive literary influences were suspect in Bagel's eyes. He saw them as subjective, decadent, or nihilistic. With such judgments, Bagel was rehearsing the typical anti-modernist arguments from the expressionism debates of the late 1930s, in which the Marxist philosopher Georg Lukács had distinguished a good line of progressive German literature from classicism to socialist realism from a reactionary one that started with Romanticism and ended in modernism. Although this dogmatic view of socialist realism was still dominant in the 1950s, by the late 1960s, a more accommodating approach to modernism was the order of the day. An analysis of the reviews Bagel wrote for the Stasi in the period 1970 to 1985 reveals that, in his assessments, he invariably prioritized politics over aesthetics, although ultimately both were interconnected. With very few exceptions, he overstated the critical nature of the works in question and focused on the putative, negative political intentions of their authors. In his very first review of Wiens's poetry, which he handed over on April 23, 1970, Bagel adopted an openly dismissive and judgmental tone, which, somewhat surprisingly, was not immediately to his officer's liking. Pönig, who had by now been promoted to senior lieutenant, criticized it for jumping to political conclusions too quickly. In his report, Berger had declared, rather categorically, "In my opinion, the verses of Paul Levine's do not conform to our political standpoint." Rather like a student of literature who is admonished for not providing enough textual evidence in his essay, Berger was tasked with improving the quality of his reviewing. He is also going to write an appropriate report which justifies this, his political standpoint, in precise terms by the next meeting. An interesting feature of Berger's reports is the fact that he almost never denigrated the quality of his peers' writing. Instead, he targeted writers' hostile political stance or the consequences of the work for socialism or the counter-revolution. This is no doubt what he thought was expected of him. It came, therefore, as a surprise to him that his officer disapproved of the cut-and-dried value judgments Berger issued in the case of Wien's poetry. But Berger's judgmental reports would in fact have been of limited use to the Stasi, since it needed concrete evidence, in this case hard textual evidence, as well as specific details of what kinds of non-orthodox or unconventional political views Wien's was espousing. Berger's officer seems to be saying in the aforementioned scolding that he needed intelligence that was more objective in style. Above all, the Stasi wanted to be able to form its own opinions about the political dangers of the work in question. After this dressing down in 1970, a pattern emerges in Berger's reviews whereby he continued to attack the overall political intent of a work but made sure to do so through reference to specific poems or passages. It was but a small concession to make to then admit that the writing was good or the writer talented. Some Stasi reviewers recommended works be published with a few qualifications, wrote considered objective reports that were even worthy of being made public, or that could have been published in journals such as Sinn und Form, as one former Stasi officer has revealed. Berger, by contrast, usually offered harsh, unforgiving criticisms with no positives, often ending his reviews by stating that the work in question could not be published. For example, in an early review from 1970 of a work by Günter Kunert, with whom he was on friendly terms, Berger attributed its flaws to a sinister intention to harm the Republic, saying, "There is every indication that we are not dealing with an artistic failure, but rather with a writing style that is consciously directed against socialism, its armed forces and instruments of power, written in a universal slave language the author is hiding behind." Later, in 1977, a few years before Kunert left for the West, Berger stated in relation to the poetry volume Unterwegs nach Utopia, On the Path to Utopia, which was published by the West German press Hansa, that, objectively, there had been an artistic decline in the quality of his writing. This represented a perversion of his talent, and Berger warned that a publication must be out of the question. In a post-publication review of a collection of short stories by Erich Löst, Pistole mit 16, Pistol at 16, which had been published in the West by Hoffmann and Campe in 1979, Berger claimed he could detect the author's right-wing, pro-fascist, and anti-socialist attitudes in all his poems. Löst, he had to admit, was an adept writer who knew how to press emotional buttons in his readers and had access to a broad readership from the middle classes, petty bourgeoisie, intellectuals, and partially also from workers. This, he implied, made him an obvious security risk. In a post-censorship review of Klaus Poche's novel Atemnot, Short of Breath, which had been published by Fischer in the West in 1979, Berger claimed that there were passages which were well written, but that it was overall a poor, indeed a lousy, Mises book that can make no serious claim to quality. Even more ominously, it was the work of a pathological psyche, made worse by the fact that it was a systematic form of vilification. Poche, he maintained, was not only the victim of manipulation by the GDR's enemies, he was also in thrall to some of the regime's internal opponents. In his report, Berger lists five major objections to the book. It contained attacks on socialist society, attacks on the party and state functionaries, attacks on communist ideology, vilification of everyday life in the GDR, and calls to combat the dictatorship of the proletariat. He concluded it would be wrong to publish the novel in the East. It represented a danger because it aimed, first, to undermine their literature, and second, the author wanted to use it as an ideological instrument to prepare for the counter-revolution. In his assessment of Monica Maron's first novel manuscript, Josepha, from around the same time, published in the West in 1981 by Fischer under the title Flugasche, Flight of Ashes, Berger argued that there were similarities between Maron's and Poche's novels in the attacks and the form. It is the same old trick, just in a different version and more emotional. He conceded that the manuscript was not without talent, but it was most certainly written to incite its readers to counter-revolutionary actions. It is yet another sorry example of poor literature that is written not in order to present a realistic portrayal of life, but to express a hostile tendency toward us and to distort reality. He was dismissive of what he called the personal mannerisms of the author. The main character displayed psychopathological traits and had a drug addiction manifested in visions and hallucinations with a counter-revolutionary emphasis, which incriminated the author. Berger was at pains to stress that this manuscript, like Poche's, could not be dismissed as an aberration. It combines intuitive hatred with systematically escalated attacks whose nature and direction point to the controlling hand of enemy agencies. In a review of Wolfgang Hilbig's volume of prose from the same period, Unterm Neumond, Under the New Moon, Berger condemned the poem's form and content, which he saw as belonging to a late bourgeois tradition characterized by a general feeling of doom and gloom, Untergangsstimmung, and hostility toward life, Lebensfeindlichkeit. Although his report makes no mention of counter-revolutionary tendencies or activity, it was far from benign. Berger extrapolated the author's character and disposition from the texts and, again, imputed a particularly pathological consciousness to the author. The poems betrayed a virtually pathological sensitivity, a sensitive feel for language with a fundamentally nihilistic outlook on life. In the early 80s, Berger's reviews continued in much the same style, excoriating younger writers such as Lutz Rathenau for their anarchic, petit bourgeois tendencies, or denouncing older writers such as Franz Fühmann, who displayed a fascistoid predilection for absurdist, irrational, and bourgeois traditions. Fühmann was more hostile and focused than Hilbig, and was a far more serious threat since he was in danger of joining forces with the far-right, neo-fascist groups of the GDR's enemies. In 1981, in relation to the poetry of the underground avant-garde writer and Stasi informant Sascha Andersson, Berger admitted some of it showed talent, but the rest was trite, modernistic drivel cobbled together with a politically hostile intention. In a brief assessment of the young poet Erwin Thomas, Berger showed some sympathy for the treatment of the theme of loneliness, but concluded that the writer was an endangered talent. There is possibly an additional reason why Berger did not simply discredit his peers' talents directly. Publicly, of course, this would be too blatant and would have drawn attention to him as a Stasi spy. But in covert reports, that were meant only for Stasi eyes, he could easily have attacked his peers' competencies as writers. But Berger needed to hedge his bets in case some of the writers he disliked proved to be successful or met with approval from other reviewers, and he probably also needed to protect his professional integrity. In other words, Berger may have been attempting to shore up the literary side of his expertise against the backdrop of a literary field that was heavily dominated by political concerns. Although Berger's judgments were always dominated by his political views, this was risky, especially if cultural politics changed direction, which it did, as we shall hear, and hence Berger usually offered opinions on writers' literary merits as well. There is a curious note on file that sheds further light on the rationale behind Berger's method of admitting writers' talent but condemning their politics. In a handwritten report for the Stasi from January 16, 1976, in which someone in the MFS had underlined two words, Berger relayed an incident when members of the Academy of Arts, Akademie der Künste, walked out in disgust at Erich Neutsch, who had openly criticized a published piece by Volker Braun, stating the work was badly written. Although he was a supporter of Braun, Berger thought that one should not debate in such a defensive and hypocritical manner. Hence, we can infer from this that not even a Stasi informant was so defensive as to criticize an established writer's talents. In another series of reviews, Berger buttressed his judgments with some dubious remarks on gender politics. In fact, Berger's reviews of works by women are generally peppered with derogatory, misogynistic, and ageist personal comments. A blatant instance of this is a post-publication review he wrote about a volume of poetry by Bettina Wegner. Wenn meine Lieder nicht mehr stimmen, when my songs no longer ring true, which Rowohlt published in 1979. Curiously, his negative impression of the work stemmed not from it being a direct call to anti-socialist counter-revolutionary action, but rather from the way the work aimed at producing a general mood of discontent, disappointment, pique. Wegner thus serves as a mouthpiece for all the negative feelings, moods, fears of unstable individuals and groups. In his review, Berger stoops to an all-time professional low when he brands her poetry tampon poetry, tampon lyric. In the case of an early review of a volume of poetry by Eva Strittmatter in 1971, Berger sidestepped the issue of whether her works were politically desirable and discredited them, instead on the grounds that they appeared to him to be the poetry of a depressed menopausal woman and thus were of no value to anyone. She frets about loneliness and growing old. Her life is a memory. Everything is shrouded in an eternal sadness. Which readers are these menopausal depressive thoughts supposed to have a liberating effect on? For whom are they supposed to provide support? The only redeeming features Berger found in the volume were a few nature poems that he thought salvageable. He recommends keeping these and removing the offensive poems, filling up the volume with others that had already been published. Berger's position in the literary field. Read as a corpus, Berger's reviews reveal surprisingly little variation in tone and rhetoric over the course of his secret police career. With their emphasis on anti-socialist or counter-revolutionary tendencies in literature, they mark Berger as positioning himself in that overtly politicized part of the literary field that Parker and Philpotts call the least autonomous and most heteronymous end, the end where aesthetics were all but completely overshadowed and controlled by party politics. At the time of his recruitment by the secret police in 1970, Berger had aligned himself with the so-called progressive, in other words, hardline forces, in cultural politics, even stating explicitly in one meeting with his handler that he intended to bolster these forces in the face of rising opposition from writers such as Rainer Kunze. In the wake of the tough stance taken by the GDR regime after 1968, Berger no doubt felt he was on the right side of power and also had its backing. But with the thaw in the political field that occurred soon after Erich Honecker's rise to power in 1971 and after the head of state's No Taboos speech at the 4th Central Committee Conference in December of that year, Berger discovered to his surprise that this was a precarious position to hold. Allying oneself with the dominant party line of the times proved, as we shall hear, far from easy, especially when the party line seemed to be shifting or softening. It is hard to say whether this was because Berger was unable to read the changed direction of cultural politics after 1971, or whether he read it correctly but simply decided against endorsing the changes. There is nothing in his file to suggest that his officer provided anything in the way of ideological guidance on what the new line on literature should be, and indeed nothing to suggest what the Stasi's line even was. In fact, one cannot help thinking that Berger's officer was not interested in spelling out the implications of the thaw and the new, more tolerant thinking on Berger's behalf. Curiously, it almost seems as if the Stasi accepted Berger's rigid position and saw the field of literature as having a certain degree of autonomy, or at the very least as having a mind of its own. By the mid-70s, at the height of the more liberal phase of the Honecker era, Berger continued to disapprove of all experimentation in literature and to peddle a position that equated any play with form or style with an unpartisan or even a counter-revolutionary stance. In his view, the use of modernist or avant-garde aesthetic styles was sufficient to place a writer in the anti-socialist or oppositional camp. In 1973, he noted that attitudes had changed since the 60s, and that people no longer believed critical writers were leading the charge of the counter-revolution, concluding that right-wing, revisionist views were ascendant in the Writers Guild. At the end of 1974, he expressed concern to his officer that a new group in the Writers Guild was advocating greater pluralism in literature and the abolition of censorship. Around this time, there were signs that Berger felt writers like him were being marginalized. In 1975, for instance, we find a note on Berger's file stating that there was a petit bourgeois group of writers in opposition clustered around Christoph Wolff and Franz Fühmann, and Berger was concerned that more writers were aligning themselves with them. On another occasion in 1976, when discussing an official literary history published by Volk und Wissen, Geschichte der Literatur der Deutschen Demokratischen Republik, History of the Literature of the German Democratic Republic, he complained that some writers like Fühmann and Braun were dealt with in two large paragraphs, while others, such as Hermann Kant, who was also a Stasi agent, only had one paragraph each or none of their own. Berger found the attention afforded Biermann, Wolf, Müller, and Braun unwarranted and declared that they were qualitatively overrated. He was particularly outraged that Biermann was included at all. He asked for an explanation of how Biermann's emotional lyrical songs could be criticized politically but still pass muster artistically. While Biermann's inclusion in an official literary history was no doubt due to a slightly more tolerant approach to criticism, one that in Biermann's case was certainly not to last, as we shall hear, to Berger it was dangerous. Even though Biermann is presented as an enemy of the GDR, in my opinion, he still ought not to have been included. There is a danger of violating paragraph 106 of the Criminal Code of the GDR. It is interesting to note that his argument here is a politico-legal one, namely that Biermann's works ran the risk of breaking the law. This is a quasi-factual argument that he hoped would trump all others. It reveals that Berger viewed his role in the vetting process so seriously that he thought it appropriate to make legal judgments. It is as if Berger wanted to lend his views extra weight by underpinning them with heavy-hitting legal arguments, and he sensed he was fighting a losing battle. He had made his position on Biermann plain already in 1972 in a report he had written for the Stasi on May 5th. He had not minced words, calling Biermann a blight on GDR literature, whom the regime should remove. In a particularly nasty aside to his report, he had recommended, "We should just deport Biermann to WG, West Germany. Then Biermann would be forced to come to grips with the society whose restoration he was working toward in his literary concoctions targeting the GDR. Berger's position on Biermann was nothing if not consistent. In many ways, though, it was even more extreme than the view of the majority of the Politburo members in the mid-70s, when the regime kept him under constant surveillance but refrained from following through on its drastic plans. This was all to change abruptly when, on November 16, 1976, in what amounted to the iciest of freezes in cultural politics, the Politburo pounced and put into action a plan that had existed since 1974 to rob Biermann of his citizenship while on an approved concert tour of West Germany. As Biermann himself has written recently in his autobiography, the regime had various scenarios to deal with him, ranging from an arrest, isolation, causing physical harm in a car accident, criminalization by tempting him with hard drugs, through to arranging extramarital affairs, and one of the more draconian ones, and an alternative to arresting him, was to expel him. It is noteworthy that the regime's actions of effectively refusing to allow Biermann back into the country, although harsh and irrevocable, were still milder than Berger's proposal to literally deport Biermann. During the Biermann crisis of late 1976 and early 1977, Berger took an especially intransigent line, and, barely concealing his disappointment at the soft option of expelling Biermann rather than arresting him, he told his officer that he had hoped the party would take decisive action to show negative forces that there were limits to their liberties. As a consequence, he found himself isolated during the events, playing little or no role of any importance for the regime in the national drama that unfolded. In the words of Biermann, his expatriation shook the entire country. As 12 prominent figures signed in protest a petition that almost 100 additional intellectuals endorsed over the following days. Among those who signed were writers Berger had no close personal relationship with, such as Christa and Gerhard Wolf, Volker Braun, Heiner Müller, and Stefan Hermlin. Among the signatories were also writers he had betrayed in his malicious reviews, such as Zara Kirsch, who had by now grown suspicious of Berger, Stefan Heim, whom he had spied on, and Günter Kunert, with whom he had only a cordial relationship and who no longer trusted him. Hence, the only opinions he could canvass were of those who were peripheral to the main events. In an account he penned for the Stasi on November 17, 1976, one day after Biermann's expulsion, Berger reported on two responses within his circles. One was from fellow writer and member of the executive of the Writers' Guild, Peter Edel, who greeted the actions of the SED as a relief, and the other from Werner Neubert, who endorsed them as an absolute necessity. Neubert's views, in particular, were already known to the Stasi, since Neubert was a long-standing and loyal informant, IME, for the Stasi. Peter Edel's views would soon become readily known to the Stasi, particularly after 1978, when Edel was enlisted as IMS Thomas. In the wake of the Biermann affair, Berger no doubt felt quietly justified in taking a tough stance on critical literature and all forms of modernism. The effect of the ensuing freeze was to confirm him in his opinion that it was best to remain true to his, by now deeply unpopular, at least in literary circles, progressive position. He possibly felt vindicated in doing so by the constant flip-flopping that occurred in cultural politics in the 70s, having witnessed how in 1971 a thaw followed on the heels of the freeze of 1968, and in 1976 a freeze eventually followed the thaw. However, like the regime, Berger no doubt underestimated the groundswell of support for Biermann at the time. Moreover, notwithstanding the crackdown on Biermann in 1976 and on the signatories to the protest letter, the regime could not undo the fact that most of the regime's critical but loyal writers, writers such as Wolf, Müller, and Braun, were gaining traction in the East as well as the West. Hence, after the crisis of late 1976, Berger continued to express his concerns about the strength of those factions in the Writers Guild that promoted negative tendencies, as he had remarked on in 1973. On April 26, 1977, he met with Kaspar from Aufbau, who complained openly to Berger that people wanted to buy books by Wolf, Kirsch, and Kunert, which Aufbau published only in small print runs, and turned their backs on the works they should buy. Should is underlined in his file. After this juncture, Berger steadfastly continued to defend that part of the literary field that was least independent and most dominated by ideology and party politics, as we have seen with his damning reviews of works by Maron, Poche, and Löst. Even into the 80s, as seen in his reviews of Rathenau, Fuhmann, and Hilbig, he showed little sign of softening in his unrelenting condemnation of anything modernist or slightly critical of socialist society. In the post-Biermann period, toward the end of the 70s, Berger's reviewing was briefly in demand as the Stasi regrouped and intensified its efforts to bring the Writers' Guild and publishers under control. Berger's post-publication review of works were sought after mainly so that the Stasi could assess how much of a security risk their authors presented. Yet Berger could not have been oblivious to the fact that he was fighting a losing battle in his efforts to stem the tide of liberalization among his peers. For instance, early on Berger lost his running battle with Kaspar over Sarah Kirsch's work, when Aufbau eventually published those poems Berger had traduced in his subjective review. Although there is no mention of this fact on file, there is mention that he had called Kirsch upon hearing that Paul Wiens was about to write a review of her poetry, even hypocritically offering to communicate with Aufbau on her behalf. His negative views of Hilbig were overridden when Reclam Leipzig released an edited collection of poetry and prose in Stimme, Stimme, Voice, Voice, in 1983. Berger made no secret of his disappointment over losing some of these battles, and in 1982 he wrote a position paper on the situation in the Writers Guild, in which he spoke about a strong sense of dissatisfaction and a certain polarization of forces among its members. On the one hand, there were loyalists, like him, who until now always went on the offensive to represent the interests of the party in complex political situations and political ideological confrontations, and who felt insufficiently supported in their work. On the other hand, There were authors of dubious ideological credentials such as Hamlin, Fuhrmann, and Wolf, who at the time were opportunistically enjoying the support of the party leadership because they were strategically useful in the struggle for peace. These writers were being surrounded by an indeterminate number of quiet sympathizers who were aggrieved, that is, vacillating, politically, ideologically. Perhaps the clearest signal that Berger was hopelessly entrenched in his hardline position came at the end of 1981, during Cold War tensions over the nuclear arms race and the peace movement. Unexpectedly for many, the regime lent its support to a joint initiative of Stefan Hamlin and the Academy of the Arts called Berlin Encounter that allowed writers, scientists, and journalists from the East and the West to meet freely in East Berlin for peace talks. Even though the initiative had the blessing of Erich Honecker and the Stasi, Berger is reported in an information on reactions from writers' circles to a contribution by the Minister for Culture, Commander Hans-Joachim Hoffmann, soon after, in February 1982, to have been angered by the event, seeing in it an insidious defamation of writer comrades who had hitherto challenged, in good faith, those political ideological negative forces in the Writers Guild. By the early 80s, Berger had been overtaken on the left by virtually everyone, including the Minister for Culture, Honecker, and even some in the Stasi. This did not stop him from continuing to brand writers such as Wolf and Hamlin negative forces and even to disapprove of the new trends in reconciliation in politics and culture. Hence, it seems that Berger's savage reviewing techniques eventually became too tiresome and predictable, even for the Stasi. Although we find no explicit criticism of Berger's method of reviewing on file, we do find other indications that the Stasi was becoming irate with him. In 1983, Berger's officer was displeased with his judgmental style of reporting. On December 7th, Pönich wrote, "With IM, the topic of reporting must be dealt with thoroughly at the next meeting. Facts must be compiled in more extensive and concrete fashion. Value judgments should be avoided." Indeed, Berger's tendentious and biased reviews had always posed challenges for the Stasi, which clearly preferred a more objective mode of reporting and reviewing, a fact that seems to have been lost on Berger. Berger's file continued to remain open until the end of the regime, although the last volume is empty. There are no extant reports from 1985 onward. If Berger had by this time lost influence with Aufbau as well as the Stasi, he nonetheless left a damaging legacy. Of all the pre-publication works Berger reviewed, only a few works that came across his table, the one mentioned by Sarah Kirsch, which Aufbau commissioned, two volumes by Eva Strittmatter, and another one by Hilbig, obtained a green light to be published in the GDR. To add insult to injury, subsequent reviewers of Kirsch's poetry were overwhelmingly positive, which made it easy for the main Directorate for Publishing and Book Trade to issue two volumes with publication permits, for Zaubersprüche, Magic Spells, in 1973, and for Rückenwind, Tailwind, in 1976. It seems ironic that the author of these positive reports was Pönich's other Stasi agent, Paul Wiens. Of the critical post-publication reports Berger wrote, once the works had been released in West Germany, the Office for Copyright gave the green light to publish a few of these works in East German editions. For instance, Aufbau released Kunert's Unterwegs nach Utopia in 1980 and his Die Befleckte Empfängnis, The Maculate Conception, in 1988. Berger's verdict on Maron's first novel was eventually overturned internally in 1987. but the Ministry for Culture never actually issued a publication authorization. Possibly even more damaging than the delays or ensuing bans on works were the harmful effects of Berger's collusion with the Stasi on the repression writers suffered. Of those authors whose works he assessed, many were to leave the GDR permanently. Sarah Kirsch in 1977, Günter Kunert and Klaus Poche in 1979, Bettina Wegner in 1983, and Wolfgang Hilbig in 1985. Others, such as Monica Maron, were issued a series of temporary exit visas from 1983 to 1988. While a multitude of factors influenced their decision to go into exile, and some were presented with little choice, Berger's damning indictments of their works certainly played a role. They helped to cement the regime's verdict that these intellectuals were dangerous examples of political ideological diversion. For instance, Berger's unfavorable assessment of her first novel was to plague Maron and haunt her Stasi file. As a series of Stasi officers and ministers continued to refer back to her initial transgression in writing a work that, thanks to Berger, was seen to depict a hostile image of a gray-on-gray socialism right up until 1987. Over the duration of his collaboration, Berger waged an insidious, secret war on behalf of the Stasi against dissident and critical loyal writers while in part pursuing his own private vendettas against his colleagues, albeit in the name of curbing modernist tendencies in literature. Berger's main motives for his reviewing work seem to have involved the promise of power and influence that working for the Stasi afforded him, however elusive this proved to be. He was, possibly, propelled to continue his work by the secret reserves of capital he was able to accrue through participating in the Stasi's impressive secret surveillance society. If we think of individual players in the cultural arena such as Berger as being symbolic bankers, seeking to secure capital for themselves and for their organizations, as Parker and Philpotts argue in relation to editors-in-chief of prestigious journals such as Sinn und Form, it is possible that Berger saw his reviewing work as an opportunity to bank symbolic capital for himself. This was, albeit secret, capital, but capital nevertheless, that still held currency in what many officers and some informants saw as a type of secret order or secret society. Apart from this, his secret reviews of literature provided him with a chance to work off personal grievances and resentments. In addition to these motivations, it would appear from reading his file that Berger was driven by an inexplicable need to ingratiate himself with power, and that secret meetings and the spiteful clandestine reports he wrote were a welcome and necessary part of a double life he rather enjoyed leading. There is a striking textual passage in his file that would support this reading. One day, early in 1979, Christian Schlosser, an editor of Aufbau, left his address book at Berger's house by mistake. Berger seized on the opportunity and diligently transcribed all 16 pages of names and addresses by hand and presented them to his officer at his next meeting. This begs the question why he would bother, since there is no evidence that he was asked to do so or that Schlosser was even under suspicion. This is a patent breach of someone's privacy for no obvious political gain other than possibly Berger's delight in providing a premium surveillance service for his handler and one that was as comprehensive as possible. Tellingly, there is no evidence that Pönig praised him for his excessive vigilantism. There is a further reason why Berger was particularly susceptible to recruitment by the secret police. Reading between the lines of his dutiful but damaging reviews and recognizing his anxieties at other writers receiving recognition at his expense, we could conclude that he feared he could not compete on a level playing field with others if he did not have special links to the levers of power. It is true that Baga never had any difficulties in gaining a publishing permit, so he never experienced firsthand the sorts of delays that most writers did. However, it does seem that Baga craved more attention than he was being afforded, especially in reviews of anthologies in the West, where he was often dismissed as too emphatic or played off against writers of the caliber of Biermann, Kirsch, and Wiens. He hoped to compensate for a lack of talent and recognition by wielding an excessive power via the Stasi. Envy, resentment, and careerism were, as Joachim Walter remarks, often the hidden drivers for many informants who felt they were not getting sufficient attention or their just deserts. A good example of this was the writer Dieter Noll, who had written a successful first novel, Die Abenteuer des Werner Hold, The Adventures of Werner Hold, but became resentful of others when he failed to replicate this success. What Walter claims for Noll could equally be said of Baga. There are numerous complaints from party loyalist writers about how the state leaders did not sufficiently acknowledge their own works and promoted the allegedly less class-conscious poets. The slighter one's own body of work, the greater the resentment. After unification, Baga's fears of becoming irrelevant were no doubt exacerbated, as writers he had spied on discovered evidence of his betrayal in their Stasi files. Kunert, in particular, was galled to learn that Baga, whom he had thought was a friend, had been shadowing him at the Stasi's behest. Baga's defamatory depiction of Unterwegs nach Utopia as the work of a hateful, pessimistic enemy of socialism could easily have resulted in his arrest, if he had not had the good fortune to emigrate to the West. For Baga, being an informant arguably provided him with a patriotic sense of belonging, albeit to what he increasingly came to see as an endangered secret society. Indeed, his Secret Service work nurtured a sense of belonging to a secret surveillance society made up of like-minded progressive forces, in other words, hardliners, that as time went on felt themselves under siege, both from the West and from liberal forces within communism itself. As Georg Simmel has argued, in secret societies, secrets bind those who are initiated into them in inexplicable but compelling ways, according to the motto that what is withheld from the many appears to have a special value. Informers like Baga thus became part of what amounted to a closed secret fraternity in the GDR, based on the belief that initiates possessed and shared in an exclusive form of secret knowledge that others did not have. Working for the Stasi afforded Baga a means of subtly distinguishing himself from his peers through, as Simmel writes, an accentuated feeling of personal possession, thereby offering the possibility of a second world alongside of the obvious world. Belonging to the Stasi permitted Baga to tap into further reserves of capital over and above those he could access through public channels such as affiliation with the Writers Guild or the party. Part of the attraction of the Stasi might have been that he could draw on secret reserves of symbolic capital and power, from which he derived additional prestige and status, as well as a sense of self-worth he felt was owed him. Although he might have hoped he could cash in on these clandestine reserves of capital and convert them into more visible forms of acclaim, it seems that he saw rewards in simply being associated with the MFS. He ultimately believed that recognition in the GDR, and not in the West, was sufficient for him to survive, not realizing that, as Parker and Philpotts put it, literary capital validated in the GDR was a worthless currency if it could not be exchanged in the hard currency of the international field. In the end, it was probably just as much the ritualized nature of his secret Stasi business that sustained him as it was the presence of any tangible rewards or benefits. In light of this, it seems rather ironic that as a true believer, he found himself marginalized in literary circles and even within the ranks of Stasi informers such as Wien's, for the very reasons the Stasi had sought him out in the first place. Rather than providing protection, the secret society of Stasi initiates left him dangerously out on a limb. And by the time the winds of change of perestroika and glasnost had swept across the country, Berger appears to have been swept aside and was all but forgotten as a writer. Unification subsequently did nothing to rehabilitate him as a poet, particularly after he had been exposed as a Stasi collaborator. Unperturbed by these allegations, however, he continued to write and publish until his death in 2014, albeit with far smaller publishers than Aufbau, and tried to cleanse his public vita from the blemish of Stasi collaboration. By refusing to participate in all forms of Vergangenheitsbewältigung, mastering the past and reconciliation, Berger forewent an important opportunity to include his perspective in the account of the Cold War spy story presented here. Thus, the story of Berger's deeply aggressive secret war on contemporary literature, which he waged both on behalf of the Stasi and for his own personal reasons, must be captured as a file story, excavated and constructed from the masses of banal and incriminating intelligence the Stasi harvested in his file and the files of his victims. As his case demonstrates, even though the Stasi mobilized writers as literary experts to combat dissent covertly from within literary circles, the system of single-blind peer review that weaponized Berger was at best a very blunt instrument of control and at worst a hindrance in the fierce cultural wars the regime fought and eventually lost in 1989 against freedom of speech.